Information har fået en ny progressiv weekendavis. Den udkommer hver fredag med en udvidet første sektion, kulturtillæg, bogtillæg og weekendmagasinet Moderne Tider, der giver plads til intellektuel fordybelse. Prøv avisen i en måned gratis på information.dk/weekend.
Goddag og velkommen til Langsom Samtaler. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Jeg har for et par uger siden talt med den tysk-italienske professor, forfatter og sikkerhedsekspert Carlo Marsala, som har skrevet bogen Hvis Rusland vinder, et scenarie, der blev til en international bestseller, da den udkom i 2024 og siden er blevet oversat til en masse sprog og udgivet over hele verden. Og nu er bogen altså nået til Danmark. Jeg skal sige som serviceinformation, at det er som sagt et par uger siden, jeg talte med Carlo Marsala, så det er inden den seneste eskalering af konflikten mellem USA og Europa over Grønland. Men det er præcis de samme perspektiver, de samme store linjer, vi taler om, nemlig hvad er egentlig NATO? Og hvis NATO ikke er en sikkerhedsgaranti, og det mener Marsala, at det stod klart længe inden Grønland, at vi ikke kunne forlade os på NATO som sikkerhedsgaranti. Hvad er NATO så? For det er NATO, vi jo bliver ved med at eksistere som en bygning og som en institution, og som Carlo Marsala siger, han er akademiker, og han ved godt, den slags bygninger vil blive ved med at bestå, og den slags institutioner er der alt for mange, der lever af, til at man kommer til at lukke dem. Men hvad vil det være for os? Og hvilken udfordring stiller det europæerne overfor, når vi på den ene side må sige, amerikanerne, der har stået for vores eksterne sikkerhed, kan vi ikke længere stole på, og på den anden side, så har vi nogle meget, meget voldsomme politiske kræfter i vores egne samfund, som truer de samme principper og institutioner, som amerikanerne truer. Det er en dobbeltkamp, en militær kamp og en politisk kamp, og man kan sige, at begge dele handler sådan set om fred. Carlo Marsala er født i 1968. Han er halvt italiener og halvt østriger, blev siden tysk statsborger. Han har været forsker i adskillige år i international politik og i sikkerhed. Han har undervist på NATO Defense College i Rom. Han har været rådgiver for flere forskellige tyske regeringer i sikkerhedsspørgsmål. Han er en international intellektuel med særligt fokus på forsvar, sikkerhed og hvad vi dog skal gøre for at skabe en fri og tryg verden. Her følger min samtale med Carlo Marsala. Carlo Marsala, thank you so much for your book. It's been very important to our contribution, to our understanding of what's at stake here. And thank you so much for coming.
Thanks a lot for having me and for your interest.
You know, you start the book by simulating a happy ending. And you say, this is how we usually expect things to go. And it seems to me that this mentality of happy endings is almost the challenge of the book. It's a problem that you're trying to solve. Where does this sense of happy endings come from?
Well, actually, I think this is what we humans are always inclined to, you know. I mean, it's quite rare that you sit down and you think, I mean, everything is going to end badly, because you have always this kind of ray of hope, you know, that things might turn out then better than you expect them. And that's the reason why I started with this sentence, that we are inclined to hope for a happy ending. And unfortunately, in my scenario, there is no happy ending. So it's a kind of preparation, mental preparation for the reader.
The reason why I ask you is because I think I grew up with this. I was born in the 70s. So I grew up with this belief that things would turn out happily, that the grown-ups would fix the problems. I don't have that. I didn't have that for 10 or 15 years anymore. That's why I was curious about it.
No, I mean, absolutely. And you point to something which is very important, I mean, in the book at the end. But I think in general about my thinking about, you know, how do we deal with this kind of military threat posed by Russia for all of Europe? I always say that, you know, I mean, I was born in 68. So you in the 70s, yeah. You in Denmark, and I mean, I lived in Germany and Italy. But actually, we are both from a generation where actually we don't know anything else than security, stability, and in the long run, economic prosperity. And we grew up in systems, in democratic systems, which, I mean, are not perfect systems, but they are democratic by nature. So we lost the sense of the possibility that even democracies can be destroyed. Yeah, we take democracies for granted. And my point is, we need to rediscover that democracy has to be defended. And I don't mean necessarily by military means. I mean, this is one part of defending democracy. But democracy has to be defended on all levels by individuals living in democracy, in the democracies. And we lost this sense because we grew up in stable democracies, which, I mean, partly we didn't like certain policies, but we never, you know, had the idea that we might wake up one day and the democratic, very democratic nature of systems can be destroyed. And this is what we have to rediscover. And this is where I take the hope, you know, because I think that if I look historically speaking, that democracies won the two most important battles of the 20th century, the one against fascism and the one against communism. So I think if we rediscover this notion that democracy has to be defended, then I look not that pessimistic into the future. But I think if we don't relearn, do you say relearn? Yeah. Relearn this lesson that democracy has to be defended, then the future is not that bleak.
You make another point in the book, which is that Putin is convinced that dictatorships are superior when it comes to lasting in a war.
Yeah.
That democracies, we don't have the resoluteness to stay in the game for as long as it takes.
Yeah.
And then you say he might not be wrong about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this, I think, is a shocking, it's a slow shock here in Denmark, the realization confronted with Russia that being a democracy might not be an advantage.
Well, I mean, Putin can play the long game, and democracies, as I said, you know, if you don't basically have this notion that democracies have to be defended, democracies have a problem in playing this long game, in basically paying the costs which go along with the support, for instance, of Ukraine. And we see that in all of our democracies. I mean, I learned, I'm today here in Copenhagen, and I learned from a lot of talks that you had elections in municipalities where the issue of the support of Ukraine played a role. Yeah, and the same thing is in Germany. I mean, more and more people are questioning whether it's worth to support Ukraine. I mean, we're into the fourth year of the war, and people are getting exhausted because, you know, I mean, governments are spending a lot on supporting Ukraine, humanitarian aid, military aid, and so on and so forth. And people don't see the progress in Ukraine. So they're asking themselves, is it worse? And this in a situation where most of the European governments face some sort of economic crises, and they are starting to think about cutting back the social welfare state. So people then, you know, are even questioning more whether it's worth to spend that much money in supporting Ukraine, which has apparently no chances in winning this war. And at the same time, you know, as an individual in Denmark, Germany or wherever, you experience a debate where basically they're talking about, you know, reforming the pension system, the medical system and so on and so forth.
I think a lot of people here in Denmark were shocked last year with this experience of the drones.
Yeah.
Because what we realized is how easily we can be terrorized.
Yeah.
That these are very, very simple, very cheap mechanisms for them to employ against us.
Yeah.
And we're very bad at responding to them. And I think this was an experience of, it's hard to be a democracy.
Yeah, and this is exactly part of the, you know, hybrid warfare campaign waged by Russia, because sending drones to Copenhagen to the airport and, you know, forcing then the authorities to close down the airport because you don't have the means to take the drones down, gives the people, the normal population, this sense of the state can't protect me. And then they start questioning, you know, the ability of a democratic state in solving the day-to-day problems of ordinary people. And this is exactly what the Russians are aiming for. You know, these kind of drones I mean, there is no military strategy behind sending drones to Copenhagen. It's just intimidating the people and showing the ordinary people that your government is not able to fulfill its promises, which is protection of its citizens.
And to a certain extent, and you make the point also early in the book, that if Putin manages to maintain some of the territory, he's already won.
Yeah.
You can see, to a certain extent, with this way that he's influencing our mentality, I wouldn't say he's already won, but he already had an effect on our societies.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I would say since the, let's say, I mean, since 2023,
yes,
Putin is counting on societies to be exhausted in supporting Ukraine. And this strategy pays off. I mean, we see very clearly how this strategy pays off. Because even now with, you know, the whole talks we had in Paris between the Americans, the Ukrainians and the Europeans, I mean, more and more European countries now are buying into this thing that this war has to stop. Yeah. And we have to find, and we have to basically also pressure Ukraine to make some concessions, because we want this war to stop, which is a normal tendency because we all want this war to be over. But, you know, it is this, the pressure on Ukraine is right now actually to concede some territory to the Russians. They're still holding, which is, I mean, honestly speaking, we want Ukraine to capitulate. That's basically what we're doing right now.
That's a very tough, but it's true. So the question to that would be, I think for a problem for many here, I think in Denmark in general, the support for Ukraine is massive, and you don't see any left wing parties questioning it. It's just part of the fact that it's a lot of it is military investment, something that the left traditionally doesn't like. You see a few right-wing parties, but it's not what you see in Germany or what you see in France. It's more like we shouldn't give more than the other countries. And so I think overall the consensus is massive and support for Ukraine. I haven't heard one Danish politician or voter even complain about Ukrainian refugees or young men here.
Yeah.
Nothing. But what I do think that the public lacks is a sense of what are our success criteria? What does it mean? Our prime minister said we should defeat Russia, but people are like, when does that start? What do you think would be our relevant success criteria for us?
Well, I mean, first of all, I would agree, because one of the criticisms I do have since a couple of years is that Europe lacks a strategy. Now, we tied ourselves too much to the U.S. strategy, which was okay as long as Biden was in the Oval Office. I mean, I would even criticize Biden for his strategy, but I can understand, you know, tying your own strategy to the American strategy. But now with Trump, we see that we don't have an own strategy. Now, we have a president who looks at things completely different than the previous administration, and we lack an own strategy. So what are the criteria of success? I think, you know, if Ukraine survives as an independent sovereign country, this is one criteria of success. The second would be if the Russians are forced to make some compromises on territorial issues. Some compromises doesn't mean that, I mean, of course, in an ideal world, you know, Russia would withdraw all its troops from Ukraine territory. And then you can have some kind of, you know, talks about autonomy for the Donbas and so on and so forth. But I think that this is not realistic. But if you force the Russians to basically leave some of Ukraine's territory in exchange for other things, then it's also a success. Right now, we are discussing basically giving the Russians whatever they have already conquered in Ukraine. This is definitely not a success in our strategy. This is not a measuring rod for success.
When we see this meeting in Paris, I feel like it's a split-screen world. On the one hand, you see European leaders and they're dedicated, and they come up with vague, I would say, security guarantees because it's conditioned on a peace that Putin should eventually recognize. But we do see them coming together, trying their best in a very, very hard situation with an unpredictable American administration. So on the one hand, I feel we're standing up for Ukraine here. On the other hand, you know, it all also looks like a picture from the old world. It also looks like, you know, a generation of failed politicians very threatened by the right-wing populists in their countries. And if you look at the substance of the agreement, it's very, very vague, and it leaves Putin with a veto. How do you see this meeting in Paris?
Well, first of all, the meeting in Paris is part of a series of a kind of transatlantic therapy session.
Yes.
You know? Because, I mean, we are talking with the US and we are talking with the Ukrainians. But of course, I mean, Russia is completely out of the picture. We are agreeing on things which are very vague, as you said. And if you get even closer, then you see that we're not that much united. So, I mean, yeah, we have the idea of the European deterrence force after a ceasefire, but actually only the French and the Brits are willing to put boots on the ground in Ukraine. The Poles already said no boots on the ground in Ukraine. The Italians already said no boots on the ground in Ukraine. And the Germans are saying, I mean, Chancellor Merz is a bit vague in that, but I would say, you know, we do deterrence by distance because, I mean, we can help from Poland, from Lithuania, where we already have a brigade, or even as the spokesman of the German government yesterday said, we might participate in some of the things, activities in the Black Sea under Turkish leadership. So we are not united in, if there is a ceasefire, you know, we have to put boots on the ground in Ukraine to prevent the Russians from attacking. So, and then, of course, I mean, at the end of the day, everyone knows that this is a red line for Putin, that Putin is not going to agree on these things. I mean, he repeatedly said, you know, no foreign forces on the ground, no troops from NATO countries on the ground. Why should anyone think that he now will agree to a European presence in Ukraine, which has some form of, you know, U.S. backstop guarantees? So it's more or less an attempt to keep the Americans on board rather than to find really a solution for the end of the war.
You also mentioned in the book how the relationship between China and Russia has changed during these last two or three years. They have this, you know, on the surface equal relationship between two partners, but it's very obvious who's dominant and who's being
absolutely
dominated. And I heard that Stephen Kotkin, you know, the Russia expert, say that he would never trust a treaty signed by Putin unless it was signed in Beijing.
Yeah.
Do you see China as a potential assistant ally for Europe reaching a peace here?
No, I don't see it, because China has an own interest in Russia winning in this war. Because if Russia wins this war, this is a symbolic victory for all the revisionist powers who want to have a new world order. Yeah, so China is supporting massively the Russians, even with military technology. So I don't look at China, you know, in some circles of the German left, you know, the idea is that China could be the honest broker. And I'm really puzzled, because whatever you see in China, China is not an honest broker. China supports the Russians. They're buying their oil, of course, because it's cheap. Yeah. They went into the Russian market after Western companies left the Russian market. They are even supporting the Russian armaments industry. So China is not neutral in this conflict. China is the most important country for Russia to support the Russians in waging this war. And the Chinese do have an interest in this war continuing, because as long as this war continues, I mean, we have to see under the Trump administration, but this would basically, you know, tie some U.S. forces to keep them in Europe. And not being able for the U.S. to do what it actually wanted to do, you know, to put all energy and and all forces they have into Asia to prevent the rise of China. So therefore, China is not an honest broker. China is a conflict party on the side of the Russians.
The pivot to Asia is a promise that America never manages to fulfill.
Right.
It's been their plan for decades. I wonder what you think about the initial criteria, because we do feel that this is a very, very difficult situation. And initially, there were made some criteria that said no European or American boots on the ground, and that the fighting should take place within Ukraine, so they bear the cost of of the war. We want to keep their sovereignty intact, but only on the premise that they fight so we have maximum protection for ourselves.
Yeah.
So we're absolutely morally on the side of the Ukrainians, but we do have very, very limited investment ourselves. We don't want to die for it, and we don't want to put ourselves at risk for it. And it seems to me that these criteria were enough to mobilize a coalition against Russia in the beginning, but they're lacking us now.
Well, yeah, I mean, the criteria were the right ones. But the point is that, I mean, if you don't want to become engaged in Ukraine yourself, then you should have supported Ukraine to the maximum from right from the beginning, which we never did. You know, I mean, we always supported Ukraine to the extent that the Ukrainians were able to defend themselves, but never really able to, actually fight the Russians in such a way that there will be a Russian defeat in Ukraine. And there was this chance until, let's say, mid of 23. But we basically were so afraid that the Russians would escalate then against, you know, European countries, probably against the US, that we supported Ukraine at the minimum level, at a minimum level. And this basically, morally speaking, you know, this is where we put some guilt on ourselves. Yeah, I would say.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I answered your question.
Oh, yes, I think you did. I just wonder, but you also make the point in the book that this new threat of nuclear escalation has been putting conditions on our effort from the beginning. And for some reason, Putin has been managing this threat of nuclear escalation to dominate us.
Absolutely.
Why is it that we've been so helpless with that? You recognize in the book that this is a dire threat, but I think you also hint that we've been too terrorized by it.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I'm always saying, you know, we should never forget that Russia is a nuclear power, so they have this kind of weapons. And we should not ignore the potential they have. But at the same time, we should be realistic. And realistic means, you know, under which condition is the use of nuclear weapons something which plays into the hand, I mean, the actual use, not the threat, but the actual use, something which would play in the hands of the Russians, militarily, politically. And I would say there was only one chance where, you know, I mean, a tactical nuclear weapon could have changed the whole picture. And this was when Europe started debating about sending modern tanks to Ukraine. This was the moment when I thought, you know, now it's kind of critical, because if the Russians now will use a tactical, just one tactical nuclear device, all of the European societies will be scared to death, and they will basically pressure their governments not to deliver any weapons anymore. So after this was gone, this chance in vertical commas, there was never a logic to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine, because the Russians wouldn't have achieved any military advantage. Yeah, so why should they use a nuclear device? Then there was the declaration of Bali when, I think back in 23, when the US, the Chinese and the Indians signed a document to say the use of nuclear weapons is a complete red line. This was accompanied then by a threat by the Biden administration telling the Russians, if you use a nuclear weapons, you will face catastrophic consequences. And I know that the Russian military was told what kind of catastrophic consequences they would face. Yeah, and since then, it's not an option anymore, because Russia can't afford to lose its two closest partner in the war, which is India and which is China. Yeah, if basically Russia would use a nuclear device, then China would be cut their relations with Russia and the Indians too. So, and this is something Russia cannot afford. And thereby, I say, you know, we were too scared of the use of nuclear weapons in situations where there was no logic in the use of nuclear weapons.
So actually, at this time, I do remember the declaration. I also remember the first time the story came out of what the Chinese wanted. That the Chinese were very, very strict against Russia, saying, as I recall it, they said not only that you cannot use nuclear weapons, but they also said you cannot threaten them.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, historically speaking, I think we have this kind of legacy of the Cold War.
Yes.
Where basically, you know, everyone in Western Europe, let's say in NATO Europe, lived under the fear of, you know, the nuclear escalation, which would be limited to Europe and would, of course, would produce devastating results. And this still resonates. There's this kind of collective memory.
Yes.
Yeah. And especially, I mean, coming from Germany, I saw how basically, you know, every time the Russians issued a nuclear threat or saying, you know, don't forget that we have weapons which can annihilate everything and so on and so forth, part of the German debate went crazy. Yeah, and it was like, oh gosh, they're going to use nuclear weapons. And it's very hard then to say, listen, where would be the advantage in using nuclear weapons? Do you really think they would strike Berlin just because we deliver some tanks to Ukraine? So it's very hard to argue then, because collective memory, I think, is so deeply rooted in parts of the European societies of the Cold War, that this kind of, you know, someone is threatening you with a nuclear device makes societies hysterical.
Yeah, and I think it hits another note, which is that to a certain extent, we underestimate and overestimate Putin at the same time.
Yeah, good point.
We had the executive of the Danish intelligence. He came out saying, well, if we're living our lives afraid that Putin will invade Denmark, then he has managed to terrorize us. Then we have made him stronger than he is. On the other hand, you know, there's also this mentality of a happy ending. Things will go well. This has been going on for such a long time. This balance is so hard. I think overestimating, underestimating at the same time. How do you see it?
Well, I totally do agree. And I mean, I would say, you know, keep calm and continuing deterrence. You know, I mean, there is no point in being hysterical and thinking that, you know, I don't know, next summer Russian tanks are driving around in Copenhagen. Yeah, this is unrealistic. But one should be aware that, you know, there is a military threat from Russia. And, you know, that deterring Russia is actually something we need to do in order to prevent him from doing stupid things. Yeah. So, and to strike this balance, especially, you know, if you are politicians, not to scare your society, but to make them aware of the threat is a difficult thing to do. Yeah, that I think this is a major problem for most of the politicians in Europe.
And I just keep piling problems on your table. But you wrote the book. It adds to another conflict, which is that we have the military threat. We're not culturally, socially, intellectually prepared for it. You know, we were a generation growing up thinking about economy, unemployment, environment, not peace and war. I'm 51. I never learned to analyze peace and war. So we're not ready for that. And we're trying to catch up very fast. Yeah. So we have a military threat that's in our minds as well. And Putin knows that. He's playing the game a lot better than we are. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you have the political threat. You have right-wing populist parties who keep saying, well, we shouldn't spend all our money fighting against Russia. We should spend it on public infrastructure. We should spend it on collective goods. And of course, what we cannot help but fear is that we will invest very fast in military, and they will point to everything that we have not invested in, not because the money went from that to the military, but to gain a political advantage. How do you see this conflict?
Well, I think that this is the most basic conflict we have, and it will play out to our disadvantage once the war is over. Because I'm pretty sure that once the war is over and Putin is clever enough, I mean, to basically do nothing for a year or two, yeah?
Yes.
These kind of debate will come back and will come back even stronger to say, listen, you know, I mean, now they have what they wanted in Ukraine. They're keeping a low profile, militarily speaking. Why should we still invest so much money in rearming our forces? I think, you know, historically speaking, if we accept the fact that we are no longer in a peacetime condition, yeah, I mean, we are not in a hot war, but we are in a kind of pre-war situation. If you accept this fact, historically speaking, countries never won a war without going into massive debts. And we should avoid, you know, exactly this kind of bread and butter discussion. And one point, I know, I mean, even myself, I was against this until recently. But I think, you know, we need to talk about common debts of the European Union to help countries keeping their welfare systems intact and alive, and not making this kind of decision that, you know, you need to spend on defense and therefore you cut back on public health care or something like that. Because this will play to our detriment. I mean, to our, I say, you know, to those who say rearming is the right strategy. Yeah. And I don't see any way how, you know, you can avoid this kind of debate if you don't say we need to do both. We need to invest in public infrastructure. We need to invest in public health. We need basically to invest in what the state is for in this kind of, you know, public collective goods and public goods. But at the same time, we need to spend more on defense. So, and if you're not Norway sitting on tons of oil, you know, where probably you can do it easily, then you have to go into depths.
Yes.
Yeah. And you have to go probably into some kind of, how do you say in English, Keynesian spending, public spending policy, because the situation is as it is. And, you know, if you allow this debate, you will lose it. If you allow a bread and butter, a guns and butter debate, you will lose it. Because, of course, ordinary people, they want to have a functioning state, and they're not ready to accept that you spend millions on tanks, but you know your roads are becoming crappy and bumpier every day.
So actually, we should embrace a kind of with an analogy that's used too much, but with a kind of FDR-like public investment in. So rearming is also investing in public infrastructure.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, this also poses another problem here in Denmark, which is felt keenly in Denmark. It's everywhere. But I think in Denmark, it's very acute because of the Greenland situation, is that on the one hand, we know we realize that our defense is not as it should be. And then I'll ask you about NATO in a second. We realize that NATO is not the insurance policy we thought it was. It was also a very easy thought, I should say. And then we start thinking we should rearm. And then comes come the Americans, and they say, well, if you don't buy American, if you don't invest in our military, then you're withdrawing from the alliance. We're not withdrawing. Then you're taking your support for us away. Then don't expect us to support you in Ukraine. So we get this pressure that you should invest, but you should invest in American weapon. And if you don't, you're failing us. On the other hand, what we were just talking about, we need European military industrial complex. We need common investment in that. If we are going to make debt, it's not to enforce the American military industrial complex. It's to build our own. How do you see this dilemma?
Well, the problem is the dilemma exists. And I mean, you can't solve it right now because Macron, a couple of months ago, said, you know, it will take Europe 5 to 10 years to become really independent in the sense that we can defend ourselves. And I would say, you know, 5 years is bullshit. It will take us 10 to 15 years. In the meantime, we can't afford that the Americans are basically withdrawing their support. Yeah. So it's a kind of catch-22 situation. At the end of the day, I would say with the Trump administration, with the speed they basically are reconstructing the international order, you know, there is no way that we will be able to keep the U.S. engaged until we are ready to defend ourselves. Yeah? So we have to speed up the process of defending ourselves. And with all the problems with the U.S., we basically have to get independent from U.S. weapon systems. Yeah?
Yes.
So there is no other chance. So therefore, don't buy into this narrative. If you don't buy Americans, you are betraying us and you are betraying NATO. What the Americans are doing, they're already betraying NATO. I mean, right now, not only with Greenland, it started already a long time before. We have to expect the Americans to gradually withdraw from Europe. We have to expect that this current administration will not fight for Europe. I mean, probably if the Russians are attacking Poland, which I don't think, you know, the Americans will be here to defend Europe. But if the Russians do minor things, you know, in the Baltics or against Denmark or against Finland, the US won't be there to fight for Europe. So we need to speed up the process of, you know, becoming not only in military terms, but also in other terms, independent from the US.
How do you, you know, it's hard for us to talk about NATO because, you know, we talk about NATO as if it still exists and you still have NATO leaders meeting yeah. and you have the buildings and you have everything. So you have this theater of NATO.
Yeah.
And this theater of NATO is very reassuring for us. We really like to watch it because it reminds us of the old days when we could be the peaceful continent under the protection of yeah. our crazy uncle in America yeah. with all the weapons. On the other hand, even if you look at Afghanistan before, you know, they withdrew the Americans without letting Jens Stoltenberg know. How should we think of NATO today?
Well, actually, I mean, take away Afghanistan because this was an out of area operation in that sense. But let's focus on the core mission of NATO, the collective yes. defense. There, for instance, I would strongly disagree with your prime minister who said, you know, if the Americans are going to, are going to send forces to Greenland, then NATO is dead. I would say threatening a NATO partner with the use of force already is a major blow to the credibility of Article 5. Yeah, I mean, they don't need to send,
no.
I don't know, parachuters or whatever to Greenland to take over Greenland. Just, you know, that you don't exclude, I mean, that you don't deny a question where you are asked if you would rule out, you know, the military takeover of Greenland is a major blow to Article 5. All signals we're getting from Washington indicate that, yeah, they have still, I mean, there is no talk about, you know, taking the nuclear umbrella away, nuclear protection away. But in conventional terms, the U.S. won't come to the to Europe's rescue. So we have to get used to the fact that NATO, I mean, first of all, is changing in the sense that the NATO we grew up with is no longer existent. Yeah, that the biggest threat to NATO is Russia and the U.S. right now.
Yes.
I mean, you know, in different with different policies, but you know, it's the same result. They're the biggest threat to NATO, and that on a third level, the question is: to what extent is NATO gonna survive without the U.S.? Is it possible or not? This is an open question. Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, it's complicated because what most people do overlook. They look at NATO as this kind of, countries are coming together, discussing, and then deciding. But what they overlook is that the more important function of NATO for the past 70 years was this whole machinery of military integration, which was led by the U.S. It's standardization, interoperability, common planning, maneuvers, and so on and so forth. So the big question is, are the Europeans able to take this part over? And I'm not quite sure whether they are or not.
No.
Yeah. If they are, then NATO will survive in the sense that it's going to be a NATO minus the US.
Yes.
Yeah. If they are not able to take this part of NATO's function over, then NATO won't dissolve because I'm an academic. International organizations quite rarely dissolve themselves. So NATO will stay there forever with the nice building in Brussels, with the biannual meetings, but actually without any concrete function.
Yes. Yeah? Yes.
And then the question is there a replacement for NATO? And this is what actually the Europeans are shying away from thinking about. Yeah?
Yes.
So you don't have any European thinking for the plan B.
No.
So, and which I think is a mistake because we have to think, what are we going to do if we are not able to take over this kind of military integration machinery?
Yes.
How do we organize our own defense? Because within the EU, yeah, let's be honest, yeah, you have the Article 42.7, which is the common the defense clause, but actually within the EU you have at least three countries, and probably in the future more, who look at the threat environment in a different way than most of the others do. I mean, Hungary doesn't consider Russia really as a problem. Slovakia doesn't consider Russia really as a problem. Probably the new Czech government, I'm not aware of, has also a different view on Russia than, you know, the Danes and the Germans and so on and so forth. So what are you going to do then? Now, how do you organize European defense? I mean, yeah, coalition of the willing. Yeah, this is what's going on right now. But this, there is no institutional structure for, you know, integrating forces.
No.
The coalition of the willing is a classical alliance by political leaders, you know, getting together, deciding things, and then probably doing certain stuff. But it won't replace this kind of integrative function NATO used to have in the past. So where do you basically have this kind of integration of, of different armed forces? My thing is, you know, we used to have until the mid of the 90s in a Western European Union, which was a kind of, you know, mini NATO, European NATO in a nutshell, also with some form of integration of the armed forces. Maybe it's time to think about revitalizing the Western European Union.
You know, there are a lot of people who would say, and I'm very undecided about this myself, that look at Germany and look at France. It's an incredible history of two historical enemies who came together and became partners. And you know, of course, the story of this train wagon in Compiègne and how moving it was to see Angela Merkel and Macron sitting on the same side of the table after more than a century of war between the two nations. Yeah. So they would say, European Union, that was a peace-building project. Yeah. It learned us how the Kantian version of peace can be institutionalized. Yeah. So we come out of a very successful peace project. On the other hand, my friends to the right would say to me, well, this was only an illusion made possible by the American military-industrial complex that you could have the peace project in Europe because of the protection of the United States. So you have to rethink Europe and you have to rethink what peace actually means when you're not under the protection of the United States. Where do you come out on that?
Well, I mean, I would tend to agree with your right-wing friends. Because historically speaking, yes. I mean, the European project was successful. I would say the European project had two midwives.
Yes.
The one was the US protection, the security protection, because then the European Union or the Europeans could focus only on economic integration. Let's assume that after the Second World War, they had to deal with security once again. Then they would have done what the Europeans always did, you know, after, let's say, 30 years fighting a major war against each other. So, but this was not the point because, you know, everything, the nuclear umbrella, the protection was done by the US, so the Europeans could focus on the economic integration. And this was a success. And of course, the second midwife, and this we see in the Monnet Memorandum, about the community of steel and coal, was the Soviet threat.
Yes.
Yeah. So the Soviet threat is now replaced by the Russian threat, but there is no U.S. protection any longer. So, and now we are facing really the problem how to deal with the security issue. And there it always gets complicated. And you see that in the Franco-German relation. You know, I mean, it's not that, you know, I mean, we share the same perception with regard to Russia and the threat Russia poses for the European security architecture. Are we able to come up with common policies? No, there are more problems in the German-Franco relation when it comes to security than there has ever been in the past. So, yeah, it's getting critical. It's getting critical. I wouldn't go so far to say, you know, war among European Union members will become a possibility in the future.
No.
But tougher conflicts, yes.
I have just one last question for you, which is that, you know, these days we hear a lot of talk about the old world and the new world.
Yeah.
And now when people are talking about the old world, it's the post-World War II that is the old world, the era of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the United Nations and NATO as an insurance policy. So we see a lot of people saying we should adapt to the new world where we can't trust the UN, we can't trust the Security Council. On the other hand, I also have the sense that we're actually returning to an old logic, that that what they called the old world was just a parenthesis in world history. And when I read your book, I feel that maybe we should get inspired by some of the old insights about sovereignty and about security. Where do you feel that we've left the old world or that we're returning to the old world?
I mean, definitely we are. The old world in the sense of, you know, the post-World War II period is dying. So, And we're going back to a much older world, which is the 18th, 19th century, you know, balance, classical balance of power, great power game. So the question is, what are we Europeans going to do? Because we're not becoming one of the great powers in this new international system. We have an interest in protecting certain things we achieved over the past 70 years. So the question is how to protect them, you know? And I think we should become more pragmatic. We should reach out to some of the countries of the Global South, offering them real partnerships, not what we did in the Cold War and afterwards, where we basically had only asymmetric partnerships, where we basically exploited them, in order to be able to keep for us and some of the partners, some of the achievements of the old post-World War II order. Yeah, I don't see Europe going down because Europe is not an actor.
No.
Yeah, and therefore I don't see Europe playing this kind of, you know, great power game like the US will play it and the Russians are probably playing it and the Chinese definitely are playing it.
Yeah.
So, but not to be, you know, completely thrown under the bus of this old, old world order we are becoming, we're getting in the future.
Yeah.
I think we need to some form of decouple ourselves from, you know, this kind of great power play and try to preserve some of the advantages we achieved in the 20th century. This is going to be extremely difficult, yeah? But I think that's the only chance. Because otherwise, my concern is, to end on a happy note, if this is the end of the podcast, that, you know, if we would meet in 3 years from now, we will have even more right-wing governments in Europe. And the whole idea of European integration will be thrown under the bus by those governments.
Yeah, I'll just add one ultimate last question, which I thought I would ask you, and then I forgot it, but now I remember. And I think it's very important, actually. This book came, you've probably written this book about a year ago.
I wrote it in let's say, fall of 2024.
Yes, so 15 months or something like that ago. And then it came out, it became a huge international bestseller. And I see people who never read books, who pick it up and feel that this is helping them think about something that they find very hard to think about. So you must have been doing a lot of interviews. You've been a lot of places. What are the main lessons that you've learned after putting this book out?
I mean, one thing I knew before, but I experienced firsthand, is really the further, geographically speaking, the further you go away from Moscow, the less people feel the threat, the less resilient societies are, the more successful is Russia with its disinformation campaigns. You know, I mean, if you go to Estonia, for instance, I was told by one high-ranking general, if the Russians do attack here, every tree will shoot back. Yeah.
Yes.
So if you go to the Nordics, there is a high resilience of the societies. But, you know, the further away you go, Italy, France, Spain, Portugal, but even part of Germany, the less you have this notion that we are living in the most dangerous period since the end of the Cold War, since the end of the Second World War.
So we're close to here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Carlo Marsala, thank you very much for your book and for your contribution and for taking your time and coming here.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Det var min samtale med Carlo Marsala, den tyske forsker og forfatter, og den bog, vi talte om, Hvis Rusland vinder, et scenarie, er udkommet på forlaget Grønning 1. Det er en utrolig generøs bog. Den er meget hurtigt læst, den er velfortalt og intelligent skrevet og tænkt, og den sætter ligesom tingene på spidsen for en på en måde, der nok er ubehagelig, men det er ikke, fordi bogen er ubehagelig, det er, fordi verden er ubehagelig. Så den gør os bedre til at bebo ubehaget i verden. Det er altid en præstation. Den her samtale var produceret, redigeret og sat sammen af vores fuldstændigt enestående hjælper, kammerat og producent Rasmus Bo Sørensen. I næste uge, der skal vi tale med vores albanske ven, Lea Yppi, som jo for et par år siden, for nogle år siden, udgav den helt fantastiske erindringsbog, Fri, som vi så også oversat til dansk udgav her på Informationsforlag. Det var en unik blanding af erindring og politisk idéhistorie. Nu har Lea Yppi skrevet en ny bog, der hedder Indignity, uværdig, som den kommer til at hedde,
på dansk, som også er en familiehistorie, men hvor hun går længere tilbage og tager den helt store idéhistorie. Som vi, og det hele hænger på en eller anden måde sammen hos hende. Og det bliver også til en slags historisk spejling af den situation, vi er i nu. Alt det får I i næste uge, hvis I lytter med, når jeg taler med vores albanske ven, Leia Yppi. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Tusind tak for jeres opbakning. Tak for alle de gode idéer og forslag, I sender til runesnabla.information.dk. Bliv endelig ved med det, fordi vi ved jo godt, hvad det er, der vinder krigen til sidst. Det er de langsomme samtaler og de gode argumenter.